Have a guest this morning who was here, maybe what, three, when did we have the Fearless Faith Conference? 2 months ago, 3 months ago or something? He's one of the speakers. Mike Adams is going to be with us this morning. I like these guys, not just because I like what they say. I get to spend some time with them, and these are interesting, good people. And I was just reading his bio, and it's too long for me to read, but a couple of things jump out. First of all, it says here that he started his journey of understanding and learning with a 1.8 GPA. So I don't know if anything he has to say today is worth listening to at this point. But then if you read on, he actually goes on to get his doctorate in criminology, sociology. Has an amusing story, but an interesting story, and he is going to be sharing a lot of this today with us. But he's an avid musician, and I'm reading through here, and it says that he declined doing his PhD in psychology at the University of Georgia because he wanted to continue playing in a band at fraternity parties. Typically, you don't make life decisions based on wanting to be able to play guitar with your buddies. But he's got an incredible journey, and I don't want to tell you too much about it because he's going to share a lot of what God's done in his life. This was a man who started his career as an atheist, Democrat, and made a profound shift. I paused because I wasn't sure if I could say that, but I'm excited to have Mike here this morning, so why don't you guys put your hands together for Mike Adams.
Oh my goodness, I don't know if I have anything interesting to say. That's the worst introduction I've ever received in my life. I just told security to cart him away. I'm a free speech advocate. I support free speech for everyone but that guy who just introduced me. But it is absolutely fantastic to be back with you guys. It was actually less than 2 months ago. I think it was in late May I had the opportunity to come down here to beautiful Southern California. I actually live in Wilmington, North Carolina, 9 months out of the year where I'm a professor. I spend 3 months of the year in lovely Colorado in the best months to be there in the summer, working for Summit Ministries. And I travel sometimes with J. Warner Wallace and Frank Turek, and we do these Fearless Faith seminars, and we had a chance to come to your church, and it was just such a fantastic experience in May. And I sat down as I was talking to your pastor, I realized that we had a couple of things in common. One of those was that during our conversion process, we were both greatly influenced by a wonderful man, a fantastic pastor from your area by the name of Greg Laurie. And in addition to that, we also realized that we either were or had been plaintiffs for the Alliance Defending Freedom in religious freedom issues of great importance. And so he asked if I'd be willing to come back and just basically share my story with your congregation. And that's what I have decided to do today, is just to come back and talk a little bit about my journey from being an atheist college professor to being a successful plaintiff and also activist working for Christian rights and free speech rights on college campuses where it is desperately, desperately needed. And so I wanted to share my story with you. Back in the year 1993, I was hired as an atheist by the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. And they absolutely loved me back then because it was in a department of sociology and criminology, which was just simply loaded with atheists, basically. And they talk a lot about diversity on our college campuses, and then you take a look at the actual faculty and the people that are teaching our kids, and you realize that they're really sort of ideological echo chambers. And I really fit in very nicely there at the school and just was very much of a left-wing atheist, very left in my politics, and sort of a militant atheist. As a matter of fact, one of the very first things that I did when I was hired at UNC Wilmington was to walk into the main office where our secretary was located. We had a Christian secretary who used to play Christian music in the office. and I told her to turn the music off every single time that I came in the office. I was a militant atheist and very much opposed to religious expression. And then something really unusual happened in my life. Actually, there have been a lot of very unusual things that have happened in my life. But I actually had a girlfriend from South America, from Ecuador, and we, in that relationship, as it progressed, I had to go through the experience of going to meet the parents in Ecuador. Meeting the parents is always a high-pressure situation, but when you have to travel to a different continent to do it, and you don't speak the language very well, it becomes a little bit more stressful, if you will. And while I was down there in Ecuador for the first time, I heard horrific stories about the prison conditions down in Latin America. And to be honest with you, the stories that I heard were so crazy that I didn't even believe them to be true. And so I decided to actually go back. And instead of doing it for pleasure, I decided to go back for business and arrange a teaching exchange at one of the universities in Quito, Ecuador, where I would go down there for 17 days to teach. And they were going through a big debate, it was back in 1996, and they were going through a huge debate about the question of whether they were going to bring back the death penalty. They hadn't had it since the year 1958, and so I said, well, I'll go down there and give a few lectures on the issue of the death penalty. And my real reason, though, was that I wanted to get inside of one of those prisons, and I wanted to go on a tour for a few hours. My mother had worked with Chuck Colson's prison ministries for years, and even though I wasn't a believer, there was something about a concern for the plight of prisoners that just kind of soaked into my psyche, if you will, and I was just kind of concerned about the things that I had heard. And fortunately, through some connections, I was able to arrange that tour and spend 3 hours inside of a prison down there in Quito, Ecuador. And it was 3 hours that would completely transform my life. I had no idea that I was going to walk in at 11 o'clock in the morning as an atheist and walk out 3 hours later as a former atheist. But the things that I saw in there were just incredible. First of all, I could barely breathe when I walked in the place. The pipes were all broken, and there was human waste absolutely everywhere. Urine and fecal matter mixed together, just in puddles and things dispersed throughout the entire prison. And I had a chance to walk into a prison cell where 45 men were packed into 36 square meters. And through the use of a translator, my Spanish was very bad, still is, and I had a couple of actually English-speaking guards there that went with me, and they protected me, and they translated, basically. And I realized that they had people who were charged with larceny, with rapists and murderers thrown into basically the same prison cell. I had an opportunity to walk through the kitchen where I saw that they had huge vats where they would actually buy rotten meat from the market in Old Town Quito and vegetables that had been infested basically with insects and everything. They just took them and chopped them up and boiled them basically to try and sanitize them, and they actually fed them to the prisoners. And when I was down there on the first floor, right after I went through and had an opportunity to tour the kitchen, I actually witnessed a very severe beating of a young man who I don't know how old he was, but he must have looked like he was about 18 years old. And a couple of prison guards actually had him up against a wall, and they had a small bat, and they were just beating him on the back of the legs, and they were doing it around his rib cage, and it was just absolutely brutal. When they saw me come into the room, they stopped it immediately, of course. And I would later learn the reason why he was being beaten. They actually charged rent to prisoners there in Ecuador to stay in the prison. It was 67 cents a week to stay down there on the first floor. And if you didn't have your relatives out there begging in the streets to raise your rent money and you wanted to eat, they'd take a bat out and just beat you to teach you a lesson. And so I went through, after some time of walking through the first floor and witnessing those conditions, I had an opportunity to go to the nicer portion of the prison, which was upstairs, where if you paid $1.67 a week, which was 5,000 sucres at the time, then you got the privilege, the pleasure of only staying with 20 people in one of those 36 square meter cells. And you also had a right to have personal effects. And they would bring in stuff to you from the outside. You had special privileges for paying the extra money. And I had an opportunity to sit down and interview two prisoners there, the only two English-speaking prisoners that I could find. And as I was interviewing one of them, it was fascinating. His name was Pedro Castillo. He had been imprisoned at the age of 21 for allegedly forging his passport. Now, the truth was he refused to pay a bribe to someone when he was coming back to Ecuador from Colombia. And as a result of that, he was imprisoned for misdemeanor forgery. He waited on his trial for 3 years. His trial took 1 year, and after he was acquitted of the charges, he was waiting to raise enough money for a processing fee. That means a bribe, so that they would let him out of the prison. He'd spent between the ages of 21 and 25. Think about that. Prime years of his youth, spending time rotting in this Ecuadorian prison for a misdemeanor crime he actually did not commit. I had an opportunity to interview another man whose name I don't know. I sat in with him in his bunk upstairs in the prison. And I noticed that he had a Bible, and he also had a picture of Jesus there. And I was conversing with him about how he had been arrested for a petty larceny charge. And petty larceny, by the way, at that time in Ecuador, carried a maximum sentence only of 2 months. He had been waiting on his trial for 2 years. And we were talking about the lack of right to counsel, the lack of a right to jury, and all those aspects of the criminal justice system, which fascinated me, because I'm a criminologist, when all of a sudden at the end of the interview, he thanked me for, his heart was full of gratitude, and he thanked me for coming in there to talk to him, because he said, no one cares about us. We just sit here in the prison and we rot. And I'll tell you something, I realized at that moment that man had something that I didn't have. And even while he was in the prison, he was in a sense free. And I would walk out of that prison in a few minutes, but in some ways, I felt like a prisoner to my own ideology on that day. And before I left, I had an opportunity to sit down and interview also a couple of the prison guards. And I'd heard rumors that down in Ecuador, when they arrested people, they would place them in the back of a police van, and they would actually wrap wire around their genitalia, and they would begin to ask them questions about whether they committed the crime. And if they didn't confess, the wire was actually wired up to the car battery there in the police van, and they would simply turn the key and shock them over and over until they confessed to the crime. And I actually asked the prison guards if that was something they really did there, and they said, oh yeah, well they really do it. We don't do it. It's the police that actually do it before they come to the prison. And then I began to ask about the issue of extrajudicial executions that had been rumored to go on down there with regularity. And the prison guards admitted to me that there were times when they would have a sex offender, a child molester, or the leader of a drug cartel, and they just didn't like them, and they would tell them, oh, there's been a mistake in your case, you're free to go. And they would open up the prison gates, and as soon as they walked out in the courtyard, they would fire shots into their back with a machine gun and kill them and simply bury the body and report it as a thwarted escape attempt. Many of you have seen that scene in the movie Shawshank Redemption. Apparently, it was a regular practice down there in Ecuador, and the prison guards admitted to it. Of course, the guards I talked to said, well, we don't do it, but the other guards do it. And at the end, I'm like, my goodness, you should be a politician. Are you kidding me? I don't believe that at all. But that's what they said. And after 3 hours of walking through and being exposed to all of this, I actually walked out of the prison, and if you've ever been in the Andes Mountains, in Latin America, you know that it rains just about every afternoon, at least for some portion of the afternoon. And I went walking out at about 10,000 feet in the air up there in the Andes Mountains. I went walking out of that prison. They slammed the gates behind me, and I was actually standing out there in the pouring rain in the middle of the afternoon on March 7th of 1996. And the first thing I saw was a statue of the Virgin Mary that was perched up on a hill. And I don't throw this out to embellish the story or make it sound good. I literally looked up at that statue of the Virgin Mary and just said, I was wrong. Because I realized that my worldview wasn't working at all. I had this worldview, this idea of cultural relativism, the idea that we shouldn't impose our values upon cultures other than our own. And then suddenly it occurred to me that there is an absolute morality out there. There is an absolute moral law and an absolute moral code. And it's only possible if there is a lawgiver. out there. It is only possible if God exists. I wanted to condemn those things that I saw, but I had no basis for doing it whatsoever. And then I suddenly realized, it's like that great line from that song by Switchfoot, "The shadow proves the sunshine." You can't tell that a line is crooked until it is held up next to a line that is straight. There has to be an absolute basis for morality, and there simply has to be a God. And so I walked out of that prison, and I left the atheism inside of that prison. But at that point, after becoming a theist, I didn't become a Christian specifically. I just knew that there was a God. And so I wandered for a few years, and then about 3.5 years after that, I had a fantastic opportunity to interview one of the most famous death row inmates in the United States of America. I should say infamous. A case that went to the Supreme Court on 2 different occasions. It was the case of a man by the name of Johnny Paul Penry. He had an IQ of 53. He had raped a woman, and while he was out on parole, he had raped another woman, and he had murdered her in a vicious fashion. And after he was sentenced to die, his case went to the Supreme Court to decide whether or not it's constitutional to execute the mentally handicapped. Now, the Supreme Court said yes in his case, and since then they've changed their mind. But at this particular point, Johnny Paul Penry was 13 days away from being executed when I got the opportunity to sit down with him. It was supposed to be a 2-hour interview, and for some particular reason, the prison guards in that case actually gave me an extra hour. And so I would also be in that prison for a period of about 3 hours. And I just sat there with Penry, and I talked to him at great length about all of the complexities in his case. And I was so excited about the chance to go back as a criminology professor and talk about one of these most famous cases in American history and actually be able to relate that I had actually met with the person and learn really fascinating things about his case. And at the end of the interview, I got up to leave death row, and I stuck my hand out there on the glass, basically to do the death row handshake, if you will. And just as I was about to walk off of death row, Johnny Paul Penry, a murderer, a rapist, with an IQ in the 50s, looked at me and he quoted John 3:16 to me. And when he did it, it was garbled, of course, and he messed it up because of his intellectual limitations. But I looked at him and I said, "Johnny, while you've been on death row, you've learned to read and write, haven't you?" And he had learned to read and write. And I said, "Have you read the Bible?" And he said, "Yes, I've read the Bible." He had been on death row for 20 years. And he took this time and slowly waded through the Bible. And I just asked him that question. I said goodbye to him and I walked out. And I was absolutely embarrassed that I was a tenured professor and I had never read the Bible. I called myself an educated person, and here was this mentally handicapped rapist and murderer who had read the Bible, and I had never done that. And I considered that really to be an act of intellectual cowardice. And so I went back to Wilmington, North Carolina, and I walked into a Barnes & Noble about 10 minutes before 11 o'clock at night, before it was about to shut down. And I had a copy of the Bible, and I went walking up to the cash register, and I saw one of my students who was there working at Barnes & Noble, and I turned around and put the Bible up, because while I was embarrassed that I hadn't read the Bible, I was too embarrassed to let anyone know that this guy was considering converting to Christianity. So I came back the next night, and I bought the Bible from a perfect stranger, and it was the King James Version. Now listen, I don't want to discourage anyone from reading the Bible, but if you decide that you're going to read the Bible, don't read the King James Version first. I hope it will speaketh to your soul, of course, but the language, my goodness, I started reading this thing in January of 2000. By the time I got to Leviticus, I started to get levititis. I mean, I felt like I was floating off of the couch. You know, I'm fading in and out of consciousness. And I said, "This is just not the best translation." So I went walking into my library at UNC Wilmington, And I said, you know what? I'm going to break this up. I'm going to read a few books of the Bible. I'm going to stop every now and then, and I'm going to get some kind of a Christian apologetic that I'm going to read. Well, I picked up a copy of How Now Shall We Live by Chuck Colson, and I checked it out from the library, and I went home, and I started to read it. And on the very first page of chapter one, he begins to talk about the experience of being in a prison in Quito, Ecuador. And I just was blown away by the story. And he went through there and he kept talking about C.S. Lewis over and over again. And he says C.S. Lewis is the greatest prophet of the 20th century. And I remembered a drunken conversation that I had had when I was drunk and high and a member of a band, a musician back in graduate school, when I told someone I was an atheist. And they said, you are too smart to be an atheist. If you read C.S. Lewis, then you won't be an atheist anymore. You'll convert to Christianity. And so I just went through and I kept trying to wade through the Bible, and I get to Ezekiel and I get to temple dimensions, and it's driving me completely crazy, all the measurements. And so I stop and I read. I'm afraid a bolt is going to come down and I'm not going to be able to finish this lecture here, but I kept going back to the apologetics. And after 9 months of reading the King James Version and about half a dozen apologetics, I converted to Christianity in the fall of 2000 because I decided it was true. I decided it was true based upon a rational appraisal of the evidence. And through that time, thank God Almighty, I was tuning in and I finally found a bold pastor who was bold and who wasn't rude and who just captivated my imagination, a guy by the name of Greg Laurie at Harvest Ministries out in Riverside. And I started to follow him, and I started to read all of these things, and I converted to Christianity in the fall of 2000. And once I converted to Christianity, my life became easy, and I didn't have a care in the world. I'm done, right? Not exactly. In the year 2001, a year after that, in the wake of 9/11, I actually got involved in a very highly publicized free speech controversy. The details of that are not relevant to my message, but something happened to me. My university attempted to punish me for expressing a constitutionally protected opinion, and I reacted to that situation in a way that most people don't react to it. I got a free speech advocacy group called the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education out of Philadelphia to represent me. And we prevailed in that case in making the university look really bad, and they had to back down. And I made a conscious decision in the year 2002 that I was going to start writing opinion columns and speaking out in public about the systematic silencing of conservative speech and Christian speech on our college campuses. It was so severe that I decided I was going to make this my new area of expertise, of research, of speaking, of engaging the public in the court of public opinion. And I started writing that a column in 2002. I was invited to write for townhall.com in the year 2003. I got a book offer in 2004. I got hired by the Young Americas Foundation to travel the country on behalf of speaking out on in favor of preserving constitutional rights on college campuses. That started in 2005. And then in the year 2006, my life was changed profoundly when I met a great man by the name of David A. French. And David A. French was an attorney for the Alliance Defending Freedom. And he asked me to start to identify plaintiffs on college campuses, principally Christians who were having their ideas suppressed. And he asked me to bring forth very good plaintiffs. And boy, I started to do that just with a fervor. I'd found my purpose in life was to stand up. The guy who used to silence the Christian radio in the office was going to become a defender of Christian speech on college campuses. And I began... Thank you. But I began to do that systematically, working with David and bringing him plaintiffs. And in the first few months of working with him, I brought him several successful plaintiffs. And in that fall, I was facing the possibility of, not the possibility, but the inevitability of going up for my final promotion to the rank of full professor at my university. And David and I had conversations about whether the university would try to retaliate against me for saying that the universities were in fact narrow-minded, that they were opposed to religious liberty. And we got our answer on September 14th when I applied for full professor and shortly after that received a letter of rejection from my university. I sat in my office and read a letter that said I was deficient in every area, teaching, research, and service. And as I read that letter, I was looking at a plaque right in front of me on the wall that said UNCW Professor of the Year 2000, and one on the other wall that said UNCW Professor of the Year 1998, both awarded to me before I became a Christian. And I got on the phone and I called my friend David French, and he said, "They said what? Are you kidding me?" He said, "Well, what are you going to do?" I said, "What do you think I'm going to do? It rhymes with do. We're going to sue." He said, "Are you ready for this?" And because I'm from Texas, it was a simple two-word answer: giddy up. I said, "We're going to do this thing." And in 2007, we filed a lawsuit in federal court. And because we survived a motion to dismiss, in the year 2008, we had an opportunity to go through discovery, and we found direct evidence that the university had discriminated on the basis of belief. The entire administration, every single time I would write a column or give a speech on national television saying that the universities don't respect free speech, these emails would float around, and they would say, "He can't say that." I was like, "That's my point, of course. They don't respect free speech. Well, he can't say that." But we found all of this direct evidence, and we honestly and sincerely believe that when we found the evidence that the university would back down. And then something crazy happened in the year 2009. They submitted a motion in federal court in which they presented a bizarre legal theory in which they said that every column I'd written, every speech that I'd given was fully protected by the United States Constitution. But the moment that I mentioned those speeches and columns and books, by the way, on my promotion application, they were transformed into government speech, and I was stripped of my First Amendment rights entirely. And that is so important for us to understand. We look around at the crazy things politicians and professors and college administrators do, and we say, "Man, those people are ignorant of the First Amendment." No, they're not. They are at war with the First Amendment. They are at war with your religious liberties. And we believe that the theory was so absurd that no rational judge could possibly accept that legal argument. And then in March of 2010, to that point, the most devastating day of my life, that judge threw my case out of court, and he accepted the argument. And after 8 years of being an advocate for Christian speech on college campuses, I had to go home that evening to every channel saying, "Mike Adams, free speech advocate, loses First Amendment case." The media loved it. And I went home that evening, the only night in my entire life. I am 51 years old now, and it's the only night I remember staring at the ceiling all night long and not being able to go to sleep because I thought my life was over. I get up the next morning at 7 o'clock. I don't wake up. I just get out of the bed, and I start to read as I do. Every morning I'll read for 2 hours, basically. And about 9 o'clock, the phone rings, and a young attorney for the Alliance Defending Freedom calls me on the phone. His name is Joe Martins, and he says, "Mike, you're a good friend of mine. I'm sorry I couldn't call and give you the bad news yesterday, but I know you feel defeated." He said, "This is not defeat." He says, "This is providence." And at this point, it's good he wasn't in the room with me, because I would have had a relapse, and I would have punched him in the face if I would have seen him. He said to me, "No, this is providence." I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "We're going to appeal this case in front of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals." And he says, "We are going to win an important First Amendment precedent. He goes, your name is going to be in all the law books across the country. And if we lose, he goes, that would be even better. At this point, I think my attorney's insane. Can I fire him? Can I fire this guy now? He says, if your case goes to the Supreme Court, the liberal justices will understand the implications for professors' speech. And because the professors are usually liberal, they'll side with you. He goes, no, this is not defeat. This is providence. And so I get off the phone with him as quickly as I possibly can. And I go into my office at 11 o'clock in the morning for my office hours. Suddenly the phone rings and a kid calls from Rhode Island. And he says, we want you to come out and speak on the issue of First Amendment rights on college campuses. We want you to come out in May. I said, what's the honorarium? He told me and I accepted because I converted to, you know, capitalism as well. I got to buy those guitars and stuff, right? I've just got to. And so we made a deal for me to come out in May and speak at his school. And before I got off the phone with him, I said, oh, now what college are you calling from? He says, oh, this is Providence. I said, is this a joke? Seriously, what college are you calling from? Providence College. It was the exact phrase that my attorney had used a couple of hours before. It was like a God wink. And it's like, oh my goodness, I think we might win this thing. A year later, we go marching into the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia. My three attorneys for the Alliance Defending Freedom took on the Attorney General of North Carolina, and we destroyed them. We won a very important First Amendment precedent, which is now taught in law schools all across the United States of America, the case of Adams versus UNCW, that says that when a professor decides to speak out on issues of public concern, if he mentions that in his promotion materials or his annual evaluations, it still is not considered to be an official duty. It still has a First Amendment component that is fully protected. We won that case, and we won an important victory for college professors all across the country who would dare to be whistleblowers and criticize government entities when they violate the First Amendment. And so at that point, I thought, these people are going to settle. They didn't settle. They didn't come forth with an offer. They kept coming back with motions. They said, oh, we argued before that we had a right to engage in viewpoint discrimination, but we actually didn't do it. So here's why the case should be dismissed. The judge, in the midst of all this, gets frustrated. And on two different occasions, he forces us into mediation in federal court. And we went in there, and I had to endure insults for hours on end. Personal attacks and insults from the Attorney General of the state of North Carolina and his associates for hours on end. At some point, the judge just gets frustrated with it and says, I'm not going to try and order you guys to sit in and discuss this thing and work it out. It's time we had a trial. And he gave me a 3-day trial. He said, you've got 3 days to go in there and make your case. That's all you've got. And in March, on March 17th of 2014, almost 7 years after filing that suit, I got my day in court. Every man gets his day in court. I got my decade in court. I just didn't realize it. But I had an opportunity to do something that made me proud. People say Christians shouldn't litigate. I disagree with that. In this country, we don't throw rocks at each other in the street. We go and we have civil litigation, where you go in air conditioning and you sit there and you take an oath and you sit in front of a jury of your peers like they don't have in Ecuador. And you tell your story. And for 3 hours, I told my story about how my teaching evaluations, my peer evaluations were sky high until I converted to Christianity. My teaching evaluations remained at the top of the department, but the evaluations from the atheist professors plummeted. and we presented evidence for 3 hours. It was fantastic to be able to get up there on the stand and tell my story under oath. Then we went and we had lunch and came back for cross-examination. That was not quite so fantastic. For the record, I strongly prefer direct examination over cross-examination, because those attorneys working for the Attorney General went and took pieces of my opinion columns intentionally out of context and played the race card and the gender card from the bottom of the deck in front of my students who were there to watch the trial. And I was so utterly humiliated by what happened in that courtroom that at the end of the day, I just walked up to my attorneys and I said, I am sorry that I dragged you through this. I'm sorry I filed this lawsuit. I know there's no possible way that we can win. And I went home that evening, stared at the ceiling. Somehow that evening, I fell asleep. And I got up at 7 o'clock in the morning to go in for the next day of trial, which started at about 8:30. And I was just exhausted, beaten, convinced we had no prayer and no chance. When my brilliant attorney for the ADF got the principal defendant on the stand, and before he began to ask her questions, he goes, watch this. I'm just going to ask her questions from her deposition 5 years ago. It's been so long, I'm pretty sure she forgot the answers. Watch. This is going to be good. And in the course of 1 hour, he caught the principal defendant committing perjury in federal court 3 times in 1 hour. I went walking out of that courtroom saying, oh, guys, by the way, that apology I gave you yesterday, forget about it. I'm not sorry at all. I'm so glad we did this thing. As a matter of fact, I'm having fun at this point. And we came back in for the third day of the trial. And my brilliant attorney, David French, had an opportunity to get up and summarize the evidence in a closing statement. And in federal court, when you're the plaintiff, you have an opportunity to do a rebuttal speech, a short rebuttal closing argument. And in the remaining 30 minutes that he had, he decided to just give a history lesson on the Constitution. And he talked about how we need a Constitution in this country to preserve liberty, but it's not enough. We need a First Amendment. And the absolute cornerstone of that First Amendment is the idea of free speech and religious liberty. And he says, I don't agree with everything Mike Adams says. He's my friend, but I don't always agree with him. And I got a right to disagree. But that's not the government's job. They're not supposed to be doing that. And in the midst of this lecture on the history of the First Amendment, I see this woman sitting on the front row of the jury nodding so profusely, I began to fear she would fall on the floor and injure herself. This woman had Tea Party written all over her face. And I began to have a good feeling. And then finally, when they decided to dismiss the jury, they went back to deliberate. And in less than 2 hours, they came back. By the way, they not only deliberated in the case, they selected a 4-person and they ordered pizza. And in less than 2 hours, the door opens. And I see that woman holding the envelope. Madam Tea Party was chosen as the 4-person. I didn't need to hear that verdict to know what that verdict was. But I can tell you something, the opposition certainly heard when they read that verdict. Because the chair, the former chair, the dean, the provost, the chancellor, the entire board of trustees were found liable on all counts for individual and official liability. And they stood up and a procession of them go walking out of the courtroom. And I am standing there with my 2 Christian attorneys there for the Alliance Defending Freedom. That was a pleasant ride home that afternoon. My friend calls, my attorney and friend, David French, calls his wife Nancy. She texts her friend Sarah. Her friend Sarah texts us and said, congratulations on your victory. Love, Sarah Palin. She then wrote about it on Facebook and tagged me. I got 42,000 notifications before the day was even over. I had to unfriend her, just kidding. And the next day, Fox and Friends called and said, Saturday morning, would you like to come on the show and talk about your case? And I said, no, I can't. I'm just exhausted. I got to go home and sleep. I was absolutely spent after this ordeal was over. And I drove back to Wilmington, 2 hours from the courthouse in Greenville, North Carolina. Slept in. And I got up to check my email the next day. And there were about 400 messages that had in the subject line, God's not dead. Yeah. And I opened those messages, and I then realized what it was all about the night before, which was the day after the verdict. God's Not Dead premiered all across the country. And in the credits, they didn't tell me. They put my case in the credits, and they asked people to pray for me. It's incredible. And people are saying, I'm praying for you. I'm praying. I'm writing back. We won. Don't bother. Send. Thanks. We won. Thanks. We won. I spent the whole day replying to these emails. And within 2 weeks, something glorious happened. Judge Malcolm Howard in my case promoted me to the rank of full professor. Thank you. And he awarded me and my attorneys at the Alliance Defending Freedom back pay and attorney's fees of over $750,000. To put in the bank to defend the next Christian they try to mess with. Those who say we shouldn't fight have not smelled the sweet, just tasted the sweet taste of victory. It was fantastic. A couple of weeks go by and I'm rested up. I have an opportunity to go give a speech at a Baptist church in North Raleigh, North Carolina. I spoke about my case for an hour. And after that case was over, as I was walking through the foyer towards the parking lot to get in my car and drive home, all of a sudden someone kind of comes from the back and the side, kind of comes up behind me a little bit and grabs me by the bicep. And I turn around and I look and there's an elderly black man standing there. He's about 6'4" and he's old. You can tell he's lived through segregation. And he looks at me and he goes, I just want to thank you for that thing you've done for our people. And I said, wow. I just couldn't believe the words that he used there. This is a man who lived through segregation, who understands that we are involved right now in a fundamental civil rights struggle for religious liberty in this country. If you don't realize that, you need to wake up and realize that. It's hard not to understand that living in the state of California. And I looked at him and I said, well, you don't understand. I said, you can't compliment me for that. I said, the Lord's been raising me up to do this thing since 1993 when he hired me as an atheist in a radical department before I converted. And that's when he stuck his finger in my face and he shook it. And he says, no, the Lord hadn't been raising you up to do this since 1993. He'd been raising you up to do this thing ever since you was a little boy. Wow. And he just turned around and he walked off. And his words have resonated with me. I was so humbled by him with what he went through in his life, thanking me for doing what I'm doing. And that's the reason why I've come here to speak to you today. What's happening in the state of California with the intentional efforts to force churches to fund abortion, to shut down chapels on religious campuses, private campuses, private university campuses, simply because they teach a biblical view on Christianity. The fact that they are now doing this overtly shows that we are involved fundamentally in a civil rights struggle. And we have to resist. And I just want to thank you, your church, your pastor, Jack, for demonstrating the kind of courage that is all too rare in this country to stand up and defend your religious liberties. I came to share the story with you to let you know you can win. You can speak truth to power and win. You may think that we're all gathered here by chance. I don't believe that. I don't believe this is chance. I believe this is providence. I believe the Lord has been raising this church up since the very beginning to do the thing that it's doing now. And I just want to thank you for this great thing you're doing for our people and all the great things you're going to do for our people. Thank you, and God bless all of you. Thank you for having me this morning. God bless you all. Thank you. Thanks so much. And the worship band, I think, is going to come out and close us. But thank you, one and all.